listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have a very, very talented bassist, musician, I guess we could say producer as well, Mr. Ian Martin. How are you, Ian?
Hey, I'm doing good. How about yourself, Nikki?
I'm good, man. It's good to see you, and I'm very excited to interview you because, man, you play with some mean pocket. I saw you play with Wes Smith. He's a horn player that I play with on occasion. I just love that much. Let's go back to the early days of you falling in love with music first and then the bass. Tell me that those moments of zen that made you want to be a musician or when you first fell in love with music and bass.
Oh, well, the early days of falling in love with music. Wow. That would have to be, I'd say, around maybe about 5 years old, six, seven, eight. When the music that you hear in those years, it kind of, even if you don't remember it all the time, it stays with you. It's kind of in your DNA.
Right.
Like, I remember here, and I'm the son of a pastor, so I grew up listening to gospel music. That was what was allowed in the home, and a lot of secular music I couldn't even listen to. I remember hearing early Andre Crouch, and actually what they would probably call CCM artists today, like the Imperials. Yep. And there was a producer by the name of Michael Omartian, who used to use a lot of the LA Yo Cats at the time, which was Bill Maxwell, Abe Laborio Jr.
Yes.
And it's funny because I was playing drums in the early years.
Whoa, I didn't.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I started playing drums, and it wasn't until pretty late, 16 is when I started playing bass. But I discovered some music the other day I rediscovered it. I remember hearing Philip Bailey's first solo record when I was a kid, and I was still playing drums at that time. And I heard it. It was a particular track called I Am Gold. And I was like, oh my God. I know this bass line and I've never played it. And when I went to play it back, I realized that I had internalized some of this stuff so much. So the love of music started then. And a big influence that I hardly ever mention is Abe Laborio Jr. And I forget, I'm like, wow, there's so much Abe that I've internalized before I was playing bass just by hearing it. So yeah, so the music, the love of it started around, I would say, 7, 8. I knew that this was something that really kind of spoke to my heart from that age.
I saw Abe Laborio Jr., or Abe Laborio, bass at NAMM, and I was 3 feet away, and he must have been easily in his late 70s, maybe early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I could not believe that he had the pocket that he did at that age. There are musicians that fade and how powerful they are as far as pocket or even just the just power of what they play.
Yeah.
He did not have any, if I close my eyes, I wouldn't be able to tell you that he was as old as he was.
Mm-hmm.
And was fading as any part of his musicianship or prowess as a musician.
Yeah.
That is what astounded me. I'm like, man, if there's anything that's just inspiring, it's how good he is, but B, how old he is and still playing with power, force, and grace.
Yeah.
It's like he has nothing to prove. He's done it all. So there's something that comes with that. And
yeah.
If you ever get to meet him, I'm sure you did at some point.
Yeah.
And that experience was like.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I'm going to add on to what you said. Everything you said is true. And the joy and love that he plays with.
Yes, yes.
It's incredible. You see this man just jumping around with his bass, you know, banging the shit out of his bass and yep. just with all the joy and all the love that one could muster. It was, you know, just incredible to see. And I met him years ago through a good friend of mine. His name is Jetro da Silva, who's from Brazil. And it's funny because they both have the same, I call it joyous, youthful love of music.
Right.
The two of them, you know, they'll be like looking at each other and smiling and laughing. So yeah, you know, I love Abe. And another one actually who fits everything you're saying to a T would be Herbie.
Oh, yeah.
I got to see Herbie last year with a good friend of mine, and I could not believe that this 86-year-old man was playing everybody off under the stage. Like, I'm like, this can't be happening. Is this real? Like, not missing a thing. Because, you know, we get older. Sometimes we slow down.
Right.
And Herbie was just, was the fire that lit the stage. It was absolutely incredible.
When I graduated music school at USC, they decided to do a kind of a really cool and unique thing. They got all these music students together, and we had like a 20-piece band, and did a concert for Santana with Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter. So it was one of the most incredible moments of my life, because I was just kind of graduating school, like getting into the real world of music, and mm-hmm. hang with Herbie quite a bit. I got to watch him rehearse, which was, I think, probably the coolest moment. And I got to watch him perform for the actual concert. And it was just like this really special, like 3 days. It was 3 days. I chanted with him. I got to chant, like, you know, because he's
a wow. Because, yeah, he's Buddhist. Right, right, right.
Really, like, powerful hang. But it also showed me, like, this guy's always digging in for life. Like, music, knowledge, kind of enlightenment, you know, purity of soul, whatever it is, and it comes out in his playing. It's like exactly what you said. It's like he shouldn't be, and here I also think you will probably agree with me, he shouldn't be as old as he is and playing with as like much power and force and joy, but he also looks really young. It's like his thing, he looks half his age to me. I'm like, dude, how are you aging like this when you are like as old as you are and you've lived and done all the things? The other thing I also think that's amazing about him too is he's kind of done everything in music. He's done pop, mm-hmm. done jazz, he's done bebop, he's done funk, he's done mm-hmm. And at that point in his life with Wayne, they were doing this like avant-garde jazz where there was no time. Like time was ambiguous, and it was just them having a dialogue back and forth with ambiguous time, and it was mm-hmm. like, I was like, this makes sense because he's done everything that this but I did see him at, you know, doing the Headhunters tour. I'm sure maybe that's where you saw him, and it was just kind of like one of the most profound things because it was just so heavy, and he was kind of like celebrating something he did so long ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I didn't see the Headhunters. I wish I would have. I saw him with his new band. It had James Genius on bass, who is just he's just a monster. It's crazy. He had Terrence Blanchard on trumpet.
Wow. Wow.
Who do you have? I think he still had Lionel Lukey on guitar. Of course, Herbie.
Who's playing drums?
I don't know. I can't remember his name. It wasn't Trevor Lawrence. It wasn't Vinny Caliuta. It was a newer guy.
Chris Dave, maybe?
Who?
Chris Dave?
Chris Dave? No, it wasn't Chris Dave. No, it was somebody that I didn't know his name. I mean, which doesn't mean anything because I'm very much out of the loop on a lot of things. But he was apparently a younger. He was younger, but he was incredible.
When did you kind of choose a direction? Okay, you're 16 years old. You're mm-hmm. Where did you choose a direction for where you wanted to go with music? Were you playing kind of like funk, rock, blues, everything that you were getting gigs on? Or did you have like, okay, I want to play jazz, I want to do this, I want to play upright, I want to play electric? Like, what was that moment for you where you said, this is where I want to go with this?
it probably happened after that. So at 16, I was still in church. I was still in Toronto. I was I had started a band, a gospel group, and I started, you know, playing around with songwriting. And funny enough, around this time, I was introduced to Level 42, which is one of my, like, I always say to people, you know, you can't tell me about Level 42, you have to ask me. And it wasn't even, I mean, moving a little forward, it wasn't just the bass, it was initially Mark King and his bass playing, but then it was analyzing the songwriting.
Right.
And once I got into the, you know, that, I'm like, oh my God, these guys are like crazy. So from 16, I realized, you know, this is something that I loved. It wasn't until a couple years later, I had a grocery store with my sister. I got a real estate license. I was kind of wavering around, and my parents said, you know what, music is something that you've always loved. You should go to Berkeley, just get a degree so you can teach.
Wow.
And you know, for old school Jamaican parents, like, for them to say that is like, you know, an opportunity to study music. So I was like, so once they said, I was like, okay, this is great. I know I'm not going to teach. I'm going to probably, you know, venture out.
Yeah.
So when I got there, I still wasn't playing upright bass, actually. And I got to Berkeley a little later. I got there. I was 20 years old when I got there. And in year two, I was doing ensembles. I was introduced to jazz at Berkeley.
Wow.
Because before that, jazz was, you know, David Sanborn. I think I heard, probably heard a Coltrane record and had no idea what was going on.
Wow.
So even though I knew, you know, but I just like didn't understand it. So there was a teacher, a sax player named Bill Pierce, who said, you know, Ian, you should really consider taking up the upright, because the thing about it is, even if you're not very good, sorry, he put it like this, even if you're not as advanced as some of the other players, you'll get a chance to play, because right, there just aren't a lot of players. The one thing that I would suggest to you is learn tunes. And I kind of took that to heart. So came back.
From the real book, or like learn any tunes that you wanted to learn?
Standards.
Okay.
Like real book standards. You know, if you learn tunes, you'll get to play with musicians who are on much, you know, further along on the path than you. So I did that. I started that second year. So I started upright bass about 21. And then I came back home to Toronto for a couple of years to get my general educations. And started playing bass. I took some lessons with Dave Young. I was not all the way 100% committed to in the path of it, because I was still, you know, enjoying electric bass, but I did make strides. And so I would say it was about that time where I decided, you know what, I really actually enjoy playing straight ahead. And I enjoy playing electric. So I would say it was like the early Berkeley years is when I decided stylistically what I wanted to do.
And who was it? Who were like some of the people in your class at the time?
The first year I got to, the first year when I got there, there was Antonio Hart, Abe Laboriel Jr. They were on their last year. Kurt Rosenwinkel.
Yep.
Who else was there at the time? Layla had just left. Layla Hathaway just left. There was a piano player who's not with us, but used to play. Her name was Mercedes Rossi. Jorge Rossi, the drummer, his sister, who was an incredible piano player, but we lost her to cancer far too early. Seamus Blake was there at that time. My graduating class would have been Nate Morton, who is a drummer on The Voice, Tarek Akoni, MD for Josh Groban, and you know, we play with David Foster, and he, I don't know if he still plays with David. Michael Hamilton sax player, Jetro De Silva, who was Whitney's last keyboard player.
Wow.
Kenya Hathaway, who was a session singer to the stars out here in LA.
Wow.
Those are just some of the people that kind of come to mind.
That's the cool thing. The reason I asked is like, you know, I think music schools are cool and I've taught at a couple, but the one thing that I think that was the greatest for me was actually my class. It wasn't the teachers as much as it was the people that I was in school with and how we were interacting and how we were jamming or how we were kind of like using what knowledge we wanted to explore outside of the classes we were taking. To show. And I think I learned more from sitting in an apartment with somebody and them showing me jazz records or me showing them rock and blues records or them showing me, you know, like B-sides of an artist that I had never heard of, or, you know, just hearing music that wasn't on the radio, wasn't highly marketed, was under the radar big time, and just learning how great it was. And also learning about Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Cannonball Adderley, like all the cats, you know, mm-hmm. and getting so into jazz and just soul music, rock music, all of it. And I feel like the class of people that you're with is almost more valuable than the education you're receiving. And it's a very cool thing that we kind of take for granted when we're there because mm-hmm. we're like getting through the program. Right. But we are drawing from those people so much as far as inspiration, drive, and just like what we're focusing on too. So I'm sure all these players influenced you in a great way. How did it inspire you to either work harder or kind of like put things in perspective to know what to work on?
Well, interesting, because a lot of the upperclassmen, like when I came in, none of them were, it was interesting, all these amazing players, none of them were performance majors.
Oh, wow.
Most of them, yeah, they got degrees in music education. Some were producing. Even like Abe Laborial Jr., to me, who's one of the greatest drummers on the planet, his major was music synthesis. You know, kind of taking a sine wave and making it into a violin.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, and their thing was, you know, if you're going to spend money or get an opportunity for an education, get it into something that you normally wouldn't get, because to become a great player, you study with a great teacher and you play with people.
Yes.
And practice, and that's how you do it. So yeah, it was just even that alone, like, you know, that was incredible to kind of get at the beginning. So I switched, I became a film scoring major. That was what I,
wow,
that was my major. So I wasn't a performance major either. I would say from those guys, you know, they would just say, you know, keep playing, keep practicing. But if you're going to be here, you know, get something that, get your money's worth, something that you couldn't get from anywhere else.
Now, one of the things I love is that I lived with two bass players when I was at USC, and they taught me how important bass is in a music band, a project. And it is the most important instrument in a band. It is the only instrument that's groove, and it's chordal, and it's holding everything in place the right ways. And so I learned about that perspective in music and really love bass players on a level that it's just because they control everything. They can change a chord. They can change. The feel can be determined completely. Mm-hmm. You really comes from Jamaica, and reggae music is one of the biggest proponents of bass. Did you fall in love with some reggae music because of your roots? Did you discover some of those? Tell me what that must have been like for you.
Well, because of the roots, I mean, my parents came from, it was a very Jamaican social structure, especially in church.
Right.
So reggae kind of happened by osmosis. It was just kind of always around. It wasn't until I got into my later years that I actually got to really, really appreciate it for like the brilliant art that it is. And when people ask me, you know, what are, you know, they say, well, Tony, Ron, you know, Paul Chambers and Philly Joe mixing, you know, who are my favorite rhythm sections. And I have to say, you know, I mean, Carlton and the Barrett Brothers, like what they've done is as groovy and as creative and as genius as any other genre.
I would agree.
Yeah, when I hear some of that stuff and I'm listening, I'm like, this man composed bass lines that were, you can study them from now until forever. They're just absolutely genius. So, you know, I always heard it, but it wasn't until later I realized, because, you know, sometimes a prophet's not really a prophet in their own land.
Right.
To be getting away, to come back and realize, oh my God, like, this is the stuff right here. This is everything you want in groove, everything that you want in, you know, having parts locked.
Yep.
It's all there.
And I actually think that some of the bass lines in that music, especially Bob Marley and the Wailers, is the most melodic bass playing I think there could be. Like, sure. I can sing every bass line of every Bob Marley song, every single one. And it's actually sometimes my most favorite part of any of the songs. It's the crazy. Mm-hmm. And it just has so much power in the music. It just, I'm actually taking a trip to Jamaica to go visit all the Bob Marley spots because of that, because it's had such a profound effect on me. I've never been. Mm. And, you know, I wrote a song for Ziggy Marley. It won a Grammy, which is really cool. But it was really because I think of Bob. Like, my influence with Bob made me want to write something for him, because Bob's, what you just said, he was a prophet to me as well. And he is a prophet. And I think that power of music is something that transcends all genres. And I hear every genre in that music. It's the great. I hear rock, soul, I hear funk, I hear jazz, I hear all of it in R&B, but it's got its own place in what it represents. So I had to ask you about the Jamaican influence, because, man, that music is so deep on a level. I'm going to ask you this because not a lot of people know this. Do you know why reggae music has the beat that it does?
No. It's why?
Mimicking the sound of your heart.
Oh, really?
Deep, dude. It is so deep. And it's like, not a lot of people know this, and that is the point of it. It's like, it's like a medicinal vibe, which I think is kind of tremendous. But
yeah, you know, and to even follow up what you were saying, like, you talk about music being rhythm, harmony, melody.
Yes,
you get all of that in reggae bass.
Yes.
You know, especially what Aston was doing, you got the groove, you got the harmony, and sometimes you got the melody. And yeah, so it's, that was it. That's the truth.
Play something of yours. What do you want to play first from the songs that you sent us?
Oh, yes. And I was supposed to send another one. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you're good. We have three. I didn't see there were three on. I saw there were two. We're good.
Well, you know what? You can start with the earliest one, Brother.
Okay, here's, and who is it by?
So this is a song written by me. It's sung by Gavin Christopher. And Gavin Christopher is no longer with us.
Ian, you there? Same about the track. Was the song called Brother? Yes,
it's a song called Brother. It's written by me. It's performed by Gavin Christopher, who's no longer with us, but he recorded Stars in Your Eyes for Herbie. It was a big hit back in the day. And I, you know, was trying to get him, and he was busy at the time, and he came to the studio, he didn't really knew it, and then he kind of listened to the track, and he looked at it, he's like, I got to come back and do this, because I think this is going to be a classic. I was like, okay, thank you. Wow. So he came back in, and then, you know, tracked it in one or two takes, and that's what we got.
Wow. Here's Gavin Christopher with Brother.
Thank you. my friend. So tell me how you doing. How's it been going on your end? Say, brother, I wonder, can you help me? Because as we're moving forward, there's still a few things I can't see. My brother, I'm an old soul at heart. When I think about the future, I just shake my head and wonder. Cause brother, I look around and see simple-minded running round, running everything. And I wonder, makes me wonder, where did it all go wrong? Can you tell me, my brother?
Slamming, and I gotta correct. Cool.
Thank you,
Ian Martin, not who we said before, because this was your record. Is this on your record?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That had to be cool to actually write the song and then hear it come out the way it did, because that's got to be a rush. I know that that allows you to be in the song and then outside the song. Yeah. What was that moment like when you heard it completed, mixed, mastered? You're like, okay, this is slamming.
You know, at the time, it was really, really special. You know, you put your time, your effort, everything into it, and then to hear it come back, it's awesome. And then time goes on, and you realize you're a musician, an artist who's critical, and you're like, oh, well, the production is this and that. And then you start hearing, you know. So to me, they're just snapshots in time of I'm happy about the songs. I think the song stands up.
You know what? It's funny. It's like I'm almost the opposite where I enjoy it. And then I'm like listening, like, oh, we could have done this a little bit better. We could have mixed this a little bit differently. Oh, yeah, that one hi-hat sticks out a little bit here. Oh, you know, that bass groove was, I could have rid this part a little bit. Like, there's all these little things. And as time goes on, and I mean a decade, 15 mm-hmm. years, I start to appreciate it way more. Like, I have this distance with it that I'm like, oh, my God, this is actually really great. Oh, my God. God, we did this. Oh my God. Oh, this is cool. And then you forget all those little things, you know, over time. So, you know, it could come back in time where you start getting more of that, where it's like, oh my God, this was an amazing time capsule and moment. And it's like, especially when you said the singer passed, like mm-hmm. what an amazing time capsule that he's alive in this song and what he's singing about and how he's singing it. It's a great song. I mean, it's just grooving hardcore. Tell me what the inspiration for the song was.
You know, just obviously, you know, there was Marvin did an anthem on What's Going On.
Yep.
And it was kind of the same type of perspective. You know, greater than just, you know, Black people. It's like, brother, you can even take it larger than that. You know, there are things that are happening that shouldn't be happening. You know, just to better ourselves and better our condition. So, you know, that was essentially it, just a coming of age. You know, let's get our consciousness back in order and do the right thing.
This is what I love about musicians, too. It's like, we live for these moments where something creative can express a real kind of like transcendental like moment, you know, where it's like, let's elevate like everybody, society, mm-hmm. races, all of it coming together to make something beautiful. And I think that's why musicians are my favorite people on the planet, because it's like everything's about channeling to get to that place. And that is real within all of us. That is possible, and you see the world the way it unfolds, and it's like, yo, this is not music. Like the way the world is, the way musicians kind of treat what the moments that matter are. There's such a dichotomy. So I love that you wrote something kind of paying tribute to Marvin's spirit, and mm-hmm. what a beautiful song, what a great groove. What are we gonna play next?
I guess. Going chronologically. So this one was called Universal Love. And it was actually, I had done most of the track. And there's a singer who was signed to LaFace in the 90s. Her name was Larnae. And Larnae and I became friends. And she heard it and she was like, oh my God, there's something that, you know, I hear something with this. And I was like, okay, cool. You know, and it was actually all live in the beginning, and then she put her vocal on, and I was like, you know what, this is something like a dance funk groovy mashup. And for her, you know, universal love, she's literally talking about a very universal thing. People all around the world, you know, just have a party, have a good time, and enjoy life. And I really like what she did with it, but, you know, musically was where that was my thing. And I'm playing synth bass on it, and that's something that I love to do. I love to play synth bass. That's one of my...
And it's like, and I love that it's like come back in a big way now, because it's so... But it is the most slamming, like, there's nothing like a P bass, you know, or a jazz bass, like playing a groove, but I love synth bass. There's something, it's on the same, it's like the yin and yang of bass, that's it. Who's the artist, and what's the song?
The name of the song, the artist is Larnae Wilkerson. The name of the song is Universal Love, and I have not released it. I may tweak it, may release it in the future, but this is her. This was from her record.
Here's Larnae with Universal Love.
that universal love, that feeling when you feel, no matter where you are in the universe, it's that, no color, no size, doesn't matter where you are, you still feel those vibes.
so slamming, dude. That
thanks.
It's like, it sounds like the Black Madonna, you know. It's just like so grooving, and vocals are great, arrangements great. Tell me what it was like working with a label artist at that time, because LaFace Records was one of the biggest labels at the time, especially for R&B. Were they behind the track? Were they behind the artist? Did you kind of have a little bit of a wall between what they wanted to push, between what they were pushing? As far as,
you know what? In this case, she was had finished. She wasn't with the label anymore. So yeah, so I didn't have to. This was totally passion project. Yeah, first of all, I don't think a label would have let it go so long. they would not. I programmed the other instruments except for drums. So, you know, it didn't really fit evenly into like a dance slot. This was just strictly passion. What do we want to do? You know, it weren't thinking about placement or anything. Just how do we want the music to sound?
The arrangement's slamming.
Thanks.
Slamming. The groove is slamming. All the kind of parts of the beat that make it danceable were just elevated. You know what I mean? So what were you drawing from as far as inspiration for that style of music and that sound at the time?
At that time, I would say probably Chicago House.
Okay.
If you were to let the cats purr a little bit more, I would say that that's where it was coming from more so. Definitely more of a house with, you know.
It had elements of New Jack Swing too, which is some of my favorite music. It had like house, like early, like late 90s, but it had like kind of a throwback thing to New Jack Swing, which is still some of my favorite music because, man, that's when I kind of fell in love with dance and R&B on that sound. You know, it's like, yeah. Bruno Mars kind of came up in that, and he's kind of bringing some of that back.
Yeah, he has.
You can tell that. And R&B and some of that as well. So did you think that when you were making it, how did you stop from adding more? Because with that, those kind of beats, you can just keep adding.
Yes.
That's the hardest part. It's like, when did you know, no, that's it, we're done?
Yeah, I mean, when it started to get just a little bit, I mean, it's already a little crowded, but when you're having parts that kind of, which way do I want to listen? When you're being pulled in too many directions, that's when it's a little bit, you know, you can add spice and seasoning in places, but if there's spice and seasoning in every place, then it's just a little much.
Yeah, no, I had a nice flow of just like bringing things, leaving things out, and then keeping things consistent and big. It was like such a big track. That's what's so that dance tracks are harder than most people think, because it is about making it sound big without adding too many elements. That's the hard part of all of it. So it sounded great. It was just a slamming song. Let's play something else. I want to make sure we get to all three songs.
Okay.
What do you have next?
So this one is, well, probably by the time this gets released, it will probably be available to stream.
Okay.
This one is called Whatever, and it's something that I kind of played around with for years and didn't know what direction to go in. I figured, you know, this is like incognito. I have horns. I have, you know, it's all live. I have three of the A-list background vocalists in LA singing on it. Fred White, Lamont Van Hook, and Lynn Fidmont. They're singing the hook for me. And I didn't even know if I wanted to. Well, here's something you probably didn't know. I'm also a vegan chef.
That's great.
Yeah. I became a vegan chef about 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago. And I'm launching a company, another company. I had launched one before, but I'm launching one. And so I was doing this, which was going to kind of be the soundtrack to what I'm introducing. And then, you know, after a couple people heard it, they're like, dude, just, you know, put it out. Just, you know, upload it and see what happens. So this is a song called Whatever.
You the artist, Ian Martin?
I am the artist. Yeah, this I am the artist. I'm a little bit of a bass feature, which I normally don't do.
Awesome.
And it's, you know, a quick track, and this one definitely there's a lot happening, but
all right, I thought
that it might be nice.
Well, here's Martin with Whatever. Is a slamming theme song, man. That is fucking shit. That
was
awesome, dude. All the little licks and all the little solos, man. You can play, you can write, you can produce. Do you have a favorite of the three?
Writing.
Yeah, I feel the same. I love playing, like, even if it's a solo, there's a compositional part to that.
Mm-hmm.
And like writing a song and like seeing the spark of the song become, you know, into full fruition. It's like that is the greatest feeling I think in music. So I share of that. Where can they find you if they want to find you online? But you were about to say something real quick. What were you going to say?
Oh, I mean, probably just, you know, a follow up to that. Like, I realize it's writing because I can write a song and I'm very happy with somebody else producing it. I don't have to produce it. Although I love producing too.
Yeah.
And playing, I love to play, but when it's something from my own pen that's directly, it's a premeditated thought with intention that's going out into the world. And that is something that truly kind of that lives on, you know, beyond you. So writing is really something that I'm passionate about and I really enjoy doing.
I love that. Where can people find you if they want to find you online to produce tracks, write tracks for them, or play?
Yes. Well, for that, it would be, and I'm on IG, and I just changed my IG name. It's Plant, PLANT underscore based, BASSED,
love Ian,
underscore Ian, Plant Based Ian.
Oh, that's a smart, clever name, dude.
Well, yeah, you know, it's in corporation with the food, even though, you know, we didn't, this is not about that, but, you know, it's now it's a big part of what I do. So, you know, I've kind of trying to put it all together and, you know, this is.
I have to have you back. So I always have my guests on back every 9 or 10 months, but I may have to have you back on as a guest just for your vegan cooking because.
Absolutely.
Had some chefs. I've had a couple of vegan chefs, a couple of vegan chefs, and it is a really cool angle of taking food to the next level. So I'd love to have you on again.
I would love to be back on.
But yeah, check out Ian's music on Instagram and on all the platforms. I'm happy to myself and Ian. Ian, thank you so much for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. This interview went too fast, man. I could do a 6-hour interview with you.
Yeah, man. Thank you. Thank you so much for, you know, following up and allowing me to be here. It's a great, great experience.
Well, you are a real cat. That's why I had to meet you and know you. And I wanted you on this show for a reason. But I hope that you continue always making music, digging in and cooking your ass off because that's what it's all about, dude. Food and music, man. Those are my lows right there. So,
hey, what's better in life? What's
better in life? Exactly. Well, more power to you. On behalf of Ian, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Peace, love, and take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. We out. We out. Love.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.